This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because our microphones create a Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day, where we meet each other, talk about stuff that's on our minds, just like those real ones out there, where we say hello in a very friendly fashion. We're North Dakota, after all, and talk about, you know, our news and opinions. Maybe we're looking around on a cold autumn, almost wintry day, and wondering, you know, where have all the birds gone? They're probably up in the trees, clustered together, trying to stay warm, too. Well, we're going to talk about birds because there's an important event coming up. It's the annual Christmas Bird Count. And with us to talk about it is Keith Corliss. He's a birder, and he's a volunteer instructor with the North Dakota Fish and Game Department. Thanks for being with us, Keith.
Hey, thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the basics. What is the Christmas Bird Count?
Well, it might take a couple minutes to explain this, but nonetheless, it is a census, if you will, conducted all over the Western Hemisphere now. It started in the year 1900, we can get into details on that. But what it is, you know, as many people as you can, you know, corral, go out and try and count every bird they see within a 15-mile diameter circle plotted on some lat long, and you've got 24 hours to do it.
And when was your first Christmas bird count?
Oof, great question. I would say that was in the neighborhood of 1990, so it hasn't been all that long.
So you go out on a particular day, you've got 24 hours.
Yeah. You know, each count has a compiler, and that's basically the general in charge of running it.
Are you a compiler?
I am the compiler for Fargo-Moorhead.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm that person. And you select a day out of the calendar, you know, Christmas bird count. So you're looking at December the 25th. So you have 10 days prior to 10 days after.
Okay.
On which to conduct this count.
Have you picked the day?
We have. It's December the 16th, Saturday, for the Fargo-Moorhead count.
And what kind of information does this provide, ultimately?
Yeah, ultimately, you know, it is labeled, Doug, the longest-running citizen science project in the world. So these data are out there and have been out there since 1900. Now, granted, back then, you know, that first time in the year 1900, I think there were 12 counts conducted or 20, you know, something along those lines.
Compared with how many now?
Now we're looking at in the neighborhood of over 2,200 over the entire Western Hemisphere.
So lots more information.
Lots more information. And what, you know, these data are available to anyone because these are downloadable, viewable, selectable data on the Audubon website. And they're used by scientists or used by biologists to plot things like population trends, maybe movements, maybe numbers. And all it is a midwinter or early winter snapshot of the picture of the birds and where they are.
So what do you require of a bird counter? Is there an age? Can you take the kids out? What do you expect?
Yeah, you can. I mean, obviously there are limitations here in Fargo-Moorhead. We're not Rockport, Texas, where we go out in flip-flops and shorts.
No.
So I mean, bundling up and things like that are somewhat critical, but we all know that. No, it's open to any age and any skill level. I mean, you will be – if somebody raises their hand and says, yeah, I want to do this or I want to be part of this, you know, you'll be assigned to a group or a team or something. And all you need to do is go, hey, what's that?
And as a compiler, you're kind of telling people where roughly to go?
Yeah, you know, good point. Good question, rather. You know, all I've done, you know, since I've been handed the reins for this particular count is appoint, you know, to use a military reference again, appoint a bunch of lieutenants and let them run with their areas. And at the end of the day, you know, we get together and we add them all up.
So you don't just go to your backyard and create a temporary bird feeder and wait for stuff to show up?
You can. That's part of it too.
Okay.
You know, broadly speaking, there are two sort of ways looking at this. There are people that go out, quote, in the field and those that will stay home and watch their feeders. And that's an important element to this too because we'll end up, you know, somebody will have some strange bird overwintering at their feeder and they'll typically go to that for weeks at a time, you know. And, we'll get reports that way too.
So if you send me to a certain place on December 16th for the Christmas bird count and I see – do I count individual sparrows?
You do. Yeah, you know, so if you go to the landfill and count your European starlings, for instance, the numbers will
who's
be
getting
in the,
that
in,
assignment?
In the thousands.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know the guy who gets the assignment. So, yeah, so obviously there's some estimation going on, and there are other issues too, such as, you know, I think last year we counted 27 bald eagles. Now, you know, you sit back and you go, well, are there really 27 bald eagles wintering in the Fargo in this 15-mile diameter
circle?
Are
we seeing the same one over and
exactly.
over?
Exactly. Yeah. Or is this, you know, they cover a lot of ground, so they're going from area to area to area. Yeah, there's a few, there's several, but are there 27? Probably not. So things like that are kind of massaged out of the numbers too.
Now, since this is a Western Hemisphere study that's been going on now for over 100 years, mm-hmm. Are there places in the Western Hemisphere that are kind of preferred as sort of they want to have good counting there because this is where they have been counting birds for a very long time?
That I'm not familiar with that. I know Fargo-Moorhead's first count actually was, I think, 1909.
So
I mean,
we started early.
You started way early. I mean, this is back when there were two and three people doing it. I looked at the data, and I've looked at this for a number of years. I think the first time we had 10 or more participants in the Fargo-Moorhead count was 1959. So in terms of attractive ones, yeah, as I mentioned, you know, you'd love to do this in shorts and sandals. But I know, you know, here's a great story. There was a guy from Ohio that showed up a few years ago that, you know, raised his hand and wanted to be a part of this. And he said, my goal is to do one in all 50 states.
Uh-huh.
I think we were 47 at the time. And, you know, he was going to write a book on Christmas birds counts in all 50 states. And his experience here was fairly unique in that it was really cold, really snowy.
A really cool chapter.
But he had a great time, and we treated him well, and it was just a neat experience for him.
Well, the 2014 Audubon Birds and Climate Change Study looked at this particular aspect of this census, if you will, from the perspective of what is believed to be happening worldwide with our climate and how that might affect the migration of birds or, for that matter, their very survival.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that is emerging in terms of what you're seeing?
You know, when you're that close to the ground and looking mm-hmm. at it, it's hard to say. Most of our species here in that we see in the middle of the winter are northern tolerant anyway, cold tolerant things, maybe finches from Canada and stuff like that. So what you would be addressing more than anything else with a climate change type of model would be things that linger maybe that shouldn't be here, that should be farther south.
Uh-huh.
And we've always had a few of those. You know, those are the special ones. You know, you wonder why. You know, for instance, I think last year we had 200 and some American robins on our count, and people say, "Well, the robins shouldn't be here in winter." Well, we've kind of always had them, maybe not in those numbers, but it's hard to suss out those numbers like that and make it applicable to our specific count.
And with 2,200 counting organizations across the Western Hemisphere during the annual Christmas bird count. There are plenty of other ones in North Dakota. There are plenty of other ones in Minnesota. So since this is a program that goes statewide, people should be aware that there might be another place they can count birds.
Absolutely. Personally, I enjoy and I try to get up to the Icelandic State Park bird count just because it's right on that Canadian border and the habitat is unique. The birds are somewhat unique in that, you know, there's more of a northern flavor. But yeah, there's counts in Bismarck and Garrison Dam and Grand Forks and Minot and Teddy Roosevelt National Park, Jamestown, for instance. And, you know, even one as close here as Buffalo River State Park.
I'm old enough to know or remember when we never saw eagles around here, mm-hmm. ever. And now we are seeing eagles around here. So that's a change, mm-hmm. and perhaps an environmental change, because DDT was, I think, sometimes mm-hmm. blamed for the loss of that
right.
kind of bird life in the area. So are you looking for certain kinds of birds? Are you particularly interested in seeing something you haven't seen before, for example?
Yeah. You know, Doug, everybody comes to this game with a little different motivation. you know, from my standpoint, from the compiler standpoint, I'm just trying to get everybody organized and make this thing happen. You talk to the individual, and certainly there's a social element to this. People mm-hmm. just like to, you know, have fun and, you know, hang out with their friends. You know, then there's the hardcore, you know, I really want to see something good, or I want to be part of something bigger than myself, you know, part of this big citizen science project. You know, so those elements come into play too. Personally, and I think everyone would admit to this, it is the epitome of excitement to find a rare bird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when you find that one that no one else found, or you know, get a chance to see that one, you go, yeah,
well,
that's the one I wanted.
As a birder, have you had an experience like that?
Yeah, I think we all have to a certain extent. You know, the more you get out, the more you'll see.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not going to see rare birds sitting on your couch. So you got to get out and, you know, put in time in the field. And the more time you put in, those are the guys and gals that are going to find the rare birds more often.
Well, unless your couch is facing a very popular feeder.
Right.
But do you have any tips for people who are out in the wild or whatever to observe birds?
Well, be inconspicuous. Be quiet. Walk slowly.
Do what you think you should be doing.
Right. Do what you think you should be doing. And just start observing. Start listening. Start using your senses. You know, so often we crash through life, you know, with our radio blasting and things like that, or drive fast down the road. When you know, when you step out of that car and into that prairie or into that piece of woods, you know, that's the time to slow down and start listening.
Well, on Saturday, December 16th, when the annual Christmas bird count takes place where you are compiling, the weather is probably pretty important. That might affect participation.
It does, and it has. And, you know, there are other counts, and each count, you know, really has its own personality, believe it or not. You know, we've tried to maybe move the day to a different, you know, to Sunday, and, oh, we got all kinds of bad feedback from that. So, I mean, okay, yeah, we get it. Weather's another thing. There are some counts that have somehow have the ability to move a date if the weather is impendingly poor. You know, say, oh, you know, we're not doing it. We're going to do it 2 days hence or whatever. You know, we don't do that. We're firmly attached to the date we set, and we've found that even in really, really bad weather, you're going to see birds. And those data will be filtered out by, you know, the weather and the snow level and all those things go into the final product. So those are filterable when you're searching. And so
it would seem intriguing to me that you had quite a few people out there doing one of these annual bird counts in where we live here, and they're spending 24 hours and they're covering 15 miles, that they're going to see a lot of different kinds of birds. How many different varieties of birds are people going to see typically?
Yeah, there. You know, we had 30-some people in the field last year, and that's a pretty good number for us. I mean, could we use more? Yeah. And when you do the math, 15-mile diameter circle is about 175 square miles. Are you going to see all the birds? No. You do your best. And so, you know, we try and do that, and we get out and make that happen. Despite the fact that we're in a northern latitude, we see about in the neighborhood of 50 species. We typically count. Now, we've been over 50. We hadn't reached 50 until 2010, and now we're seeing 50-plus and have ever since that year.
Is there a special badge somebody gets if they see the one bird nobody else saw?
You know what? We went ahead and established an award or a trophy for, you know, quote, the best bird. And how do you define that? Well, that's up to your own.
Maybe the compiler has something to say about that.
Right, right. You know, since I have a little bit of a pull. And so we've been awarding that. It's a kind of a traveling trophy to the best bird.
And so how do people participate? If they want to take part, for example, in the annual Christmas bird count here or in Bismarck or Minot or wherever it is, how do they sign up? How do they do that?
There's a number of ways. Well, they can get a hold of me directly, or you can go to the Audubon website, audubon.org, you know, and eventually you'll find your way to, you know, find a count, and it'll eventually get to me.
And another way I know to do this, because I just did it, I was trying to find the Christmas bird count on the Audubon site, and finally I just went to Google and went Audubon Christmas bird count, and there it was.
Yeah, that's the way to do
it. Easy to find. Mm-hmm. So does the do the Christmas bird counters ever get together socially in any other way?
The post-count meal is kind of the party. The after party is kind of the, you know, that time where we all get together and whoop it up, you know, if birders can whoop it up. Other than that, you know, wintertime is a tough time to get people together, as you're well aware, especially around the holidays. So that's kind of our fling that night.
Well, mark your calendar if you don't have anything happening on Saturday, December 16th. And what could be more important than counting the birds that surround us in the nice winter day? Check out the annual Christmas bird count and check out Keith Corliss. If you're in our area, he'll be the compiler. Thank you, Keith, for being with us today.
Thank you, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, another way to count birds.
Support is provided by the Fargo-Moorhead Convention and Visitors Bureau, encouraging business professionals and planners to host their next meeting in Fargo-Moorhead. More information and complimentary services at fargomoorhead.org.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. You're listening, so you must like us, so you probably want to know all the ways you can listen. You can listen on the radio. Traditionally, you can be a modern and load the Prairie Public app on your smartphone or tablet. You can be cosmopolitan and use TuneIn or iHeartRadio, or maybe you want to be a hipster. You can listen to NPR One. However you like to listen, we're glad to have you.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura is a scientist and a writer. He teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau, and he writes Natural North Dakota, a series of essays about the plant and animal life that surround us on the northern plains. Today, his essay is about another way to count winter birds.
It's not too early to start thinking about feeding the birds this winter. As those of you with bird feeders in your yard know, there's considerable yearly variation in the visitors to the feeders. Much of that difference is related to the seed and fruit crop in Canada. Each summer, Ron Pittaway, an ornithologist from Ontario, along with the help of many observers, assesses the abundance of important fruit and seed crops of finches and some other birds across eastern Canada. He can then make predictions on the movement of these birds during the upcoming winter. He also occasionally includes estimates of the fruit and seed crops in western Canada. Although his estimates are more accurate for the eastern areas of the U.S. and Canada, his finch forecast can give us some indications of what feathered friends from the north might show up in our feeders. Pittaway's general forecast for this winter is that many of these birds will probably stay up north because of a bumper crop of conifer seeds in eastern Canada. As a result, we can expect the usual visitors, but probably not many northern visitors. One of the winter visitors I look forward to seeing each year is the evening grosbeak, but it doesn't look good for this winter. The bumper crop of conifer seeds in eastern Canada combined with spruce budworm infestations will keep them up north this year. Pine grosbeaks will also likely stay north because of an abundant crop of mountain ash fruits across much of Canada. The situation is similar for purple finches, particularly eastward. I have, however, already seen a few pine siskins hitting our sunflower feeders. That's a little unexpected considering the bumper crop of conifer seeds. The presence of pine siskins may, however, be the result of many forest fires in western Canada and the United States this summer and fall. So perhaps we'll see a few visitors from the west at our feeders this winter. So keep your feeders well stocked. And if you don't have any bird feeders, now might be a good time to start feeding the birds. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
One place to find a large flock of birds would be in a sunflower field around harvest time. Well, people love sunflowers, too. It's a global commodity crop that's growing in demand. Researchers have unlocked the genetic code of the entire plant, which could lead to better hybrid seeds, making sunflowers even more appealing to farmers. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, that doesn't mean sunflowers will suddenly overtake the landscape.
Say what you will about the beauty of rows and rows of corn or wheat, they can't hold a candle to fields of blooming sunflowers. Bright yellow and cardinal red sunflowers bloom in late summer on research plots at Iowa State University.
We want to have that branching and that multiple flower head architecture.
Plant breeder Jessica Barb wants to understand more about their genetics. She carefully swipes a paper towel across the surface of a flower and transfers the pollen it picks up to a different one.
The pollen is being transferred from our little handy-dandy paper towel to actually the stigmas.
She's studying self-pollination because with fewer wild bees around, that's a feature that can help sunflowers survive. Barb wants to find the precise genetics that control it.
We're really interested in identifying those candidate genes so that we can help breeders guarantee that that trait is already present and so that they don't need bees.
Barb says her research is going to go faster now that the entire sunflower genome has been mapped. That's because a genome map, like a traditional map, offers landmarks and other features to help guide researchers to what they're looking for. Beyond pollination, the genome map will speed up breeding for other qualities that help improve the bottom line on the farm. Sunflowers, like all crops, have their foes. A fungus decimated the crop in 2010, taking out nearly 40% of it. South Dakota State University plant pathologist Fabina Matthew has worked since then to find ways to protect sunflowers from the fungus.
We want to know what genes get expressed when the pathogen infects the sunflower plant and what genes can be expressed as resistance when the pathogen infects.
If they can figure that out, companies may be able to develop hybrids that won't succumb to the fungus. Matthew says historically it has taken 15 years for discoveries like hers to reach farmers in the form of a new hybrid seed. With the mapped genome, she says,
that cuts back that 15 years to maybe 10 years probably, so we would be saving time there.
That might still sound like a long time, but farmers don't switch up their crops quickly because they need to feel confident they're not going to lose a lot of money on something new. Plus, sunflowers don't offer a wide array of markets as corn or soybeans do. About 80% of the sunflower harvest in the U.S. gets crushed into vegetable oil. The other 20% is for the baseball snack standard. Sunflower seeds are also used in baked goods, trail mix, what the industry calls confectionery.
What I think farmers are doing is they're looking for alternatives to grow different crops.
That's the National Sunflower Association's John Sandbachen.
And they're also looking for profitable crops. And sunflower has been a very profitable crop over the years and is something that producers have looked to add into the rotation just to give them some diversity.
Sandbachen says results vary widely, but generally sunflowers are a bit cheaper to grow than some other plants, meaning farmers might squeak out a profit in years when they lose money on other seeds or grains. And just having sunflowers in the rotation offers soil health benefits. They have very long roots, so they can access water deep down in dry conditions that kill other crops. And while they're there, they can pick up valuable nutrients. That's something Brent Hulke from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's research office in Fargo, North Dakota, sees.
We found in cases where we've grown sunflower after a sustained period of corn-soybean rotation or corn-soybean-wheat rotation, that it finds nitrogen that other crops have left behind.
And the sunflower's roots create tiny tracks that may help the next crop stretch a little deeper. So in the right fields, sunflowers can be a moneymaker that also helps the environment. If that seems too good to be true, it might be. Because despite other benefits, farmers are only going to go for sunflowers if they can make money. And right now, aside from a band of states from North Dakota to Texas, most people don't live close to a processing plant, which means they'd lose money transporting the crop to market. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks at America's farm and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, we'll look at oil patch community debt with an Inside Energy report. We'll get the lowdown on Winnipeg's bid to get a new headquarters from Amazon. And we'll get a feature look at the new Lawrence Welk Homestead attraction in South Central North Dakota. Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The general manager of Basin Electric Power Cooperative calls it an evolution for the Great Plains Synfuels plant near Beulah. Paul Sukat says in a few weeks, a new area fertilizer plant will start operating there. The plant has been in the works for a few years, and a windstorm has set the project back, but now Sukat says it's ready to go.
There are layers upon layers upon layers of conflicts, not only conflicts within the Constitution itself, but between statutes in the Constitution and between the state Constitution and the federal Constitution. There is absolutely no question that it will ultimately end up in the hands of the state Supreme Court or before a federal district court in North Dakota because of the conflicts that exist.
The plant currently produces two other fertilizers, anhydrous ammonia and ammonium sulfate. A close call for a Fargo police officer responding to a disturbance call in the 2900 block of 34th Avenue South around 3:30 this morning. Sergeant Joel Erickson says the officer located a vehicle that matched the description of the one given by the person who reported a fight.
The officer attempted to make contact with the occupants and have them step out of the vehicle to further question them, at which point the driver did make eye contact with the officer and backed up at a high rate of speed and almost ran over the officer.
The officer was not hurt, and Erickson says police made a felony stop on the vehicle several blocks away and arrested 27-year-old Dalton Beyer of Moorhead. Beyer is facing a number of charges, including aggravated reckless endangerment, narcotics possession, DUI, and DUI refusal. And North Dakota Lottery players will have a new game to buy starting on Sunday. Lotto America is being rolled out in 13 states, including North Dakota.
Play just like any of the other games that we have. Players can purchase a Lotto America ticket for just a dollar to get in the game. And then for a dollar more per play, they can add All-Star Bonus, which multiplies all non-jackpot prizes 2, 3, 4, or 5 times.
State Lottery Director Ryan Coppe says this replaces the Hot Lotto game, which has gone away. Coppe says normally the jackpot for this game starts at $2 million.
But since that Hot Lotto game, when it ended, the jackpot didn't go out on that final draw. So the jackpot fund then will roll into this new game. So for the first drawing on November 15th, the Lotto America jackpot will start at the $15
million. Coppe says numbers are drawn every Wednesday and Saturday. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The decade-long fracking boom in North Dakota sent the population soaring in oil-patch towns. The influx of people meant communities had to expand public services, putting them tens and even hundreds of millions of dollars into debt. Now, these towns are looking for stable funding to pay off their loans and hoping the newcomers choose to stay. Inside Energy's Amy Sisk reports.
Officials in Dickinson are really proud of the rankings bestowed upon their city in recent years. Livability.com once labeled it the best small town in the United States.
We get a lot of comments about, wow, what a great community. Wow, this place is so clean.
Scott Decker is the mayor. He's excited about another new ranking this year from Money Magazine.
We get rated the sixth best place to live in America. You know, it's like, well, we all kind of knew it.
Dickinson's population has grown 40% in the past decade, as have a lot of other things that make this a good place to live. All of it is clearly visible on a drive around town. I'm boarding a bus with a handful of state legislators for a tour of the community. City Administrator Sean Kessel is in charge.
All of the buildings that you see on the right side were not here 5 years ago.
There's so many apartment complexes that I can't finish counting them before we drive past. Further up the road, we see a new hospital, a new water tower, and the city's new middle school, all while driving on a freshly paved road.
The next stop we're going to make is what we call the West Lift Station.
This $12 million facility is part of the city's expansion of its wastewater treatment system. It's needed on the city's western edge because more people in this area of town mean more, well, sewage to process. From here, machines pump the wastewater toward a new $30 million treatment facility. Oil patch towns have to be really strategic when planning for growth because their populations boom and bust, just like the energy industry. Dickinson officials want the newcomers working in oil to stay here, so the local tax base remains high and all this new infrastructure gets used. But that new infrastructure, it's put Dickinson $100 million into debt. The city is paying back $5 million per year.
The whole West.
Back at City Hall, lawmakers are chatting about this funding nightmare. Budgets have tightened big time in the past few years because of the downturn in the oil industry. Senator Rich Wardner represents the Dickinson area.
There are some in the legislature that feel that now that the activity has slowed down, there really isn't a need for Hub City funding.
This Hub City funding is a stream of money from taxes the state collects on oil production.
The state funnels it to municipalities and school districts across North Dakota, with oil patch hubs like Dickinson getting a greater share to pay off their debt. But every time the legislature meets, Dickinson's leaders have to make the case over and over again for why the state should keep sending the extra money their way. It's a tough sell right now. So Wardner is working on a new formula to stabilize the production tax. It would guarantee cities like Dickinson those funds for at least a decade, all to help the town keep its head above water as it pays off its loans while keeping its streets clean and its parks family-friendly.
We will have the workforce then that will want to come and live here and help develop and produce that oil. And the more oil we produce, of course, the more revenue the state of North Dakota gets. Everybody benefits.
Dickinson wants to avoid what happened after a previous oil rush during the 1980s. The city paid for expanded public services via a tax on people who owned property in places where new development occurred, like the families that filled new neighborhoods. Then came the bust. Residents couldn't afford the extra tax. Kessel says hundreds left town.
And so it hamstrung the community for over 20 years as they struggled to pay that debt off. People recall those incidences, and it shapes the way that you make future decisions because your community remembers what happened the last time.
Officials here say they do not want to go down that road again. Here's Mayor Decker.
We don't want to tax out the people that were here before the boom.
Nor do they want to tax out the people who arrived during the boom.
We don't want to drive people away.
If those people leave, the city would still face big bills and no easy way to pay them off. For Inside Energy, I'm Amy Sisk.
Inside Energy focuses on America's energy issues. Coming up on Main Street, the city of Winnipeg asks Amazon to consider it for a new headquarters site.
Hello, I'm Errol Bepcorn. You might think that because I'm the voice of Dakota Datebook that I love history. Well, I do. But I also love the blues. I love playing the blues on my harmonica. And I love hearing the blues on Mike Olson's Saturday Evening Blues Cruise here on Prairie Public. There's nothing like dragging Broadway on a nice Saturday night and cranking up the blues loud on the radio. A blues show that can give you a lift. The Saturday Evening Blues Cruise, 9 p.m., 8 Mountain Time on Prairie Public. Oh, yeah.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Last week, online retail giant Amazon closed the window for proposals for the site of its next big headquarters, known as HQ2. Amazon will declare the winner in a few months. North Dakota considered making a pitch, but it was pretty clear the criteria ruled out the state. However, some close neighbors gave it a shot, including Winnipeg. Greg Dandewich, who works for Winnipeg Economic Development, told our Bill Thomas that developing the proposal was an intense and unique experience.
What do you think your chances are?
Well, you know, and I would suggest that the chances are somewhat limited in terms of being able to, entice a corporation like Amazon to come to Winnipeg. But really the effort was something that you needed to respond to, simply because of the fact that when you have a major corporation, an international corporation like that, that is opening up their doors to accept proposals from different jurisdictions, it gives you an opportunity to actually look at yourself and present your value propositions that exist, that you believe exist within your community, and you want to be able to put that that message forward. And so, there's a lot of competition. This is a North American-wide request for proposals, something that's quite unique, certainly from an economic development perspective.
That's right. And they did say North America. They didn't say the U.S.
No, that is exactly right. So you had Canada, United States, and Mexican jurisdictions that were competing. So, what we wanted to do is to make sure that we put our best foot forward and put forward certain things that we felt were not only consistent with what we believe the criteria of the RFP was for, but also to put forward some things that we felt we were very competitive in the other operating units that Amazon has under its corporate structure.
So in a way, even though you thought, well, we probably aren't going to get this, you thought, like, we should pull together still the reasons. This is a chance to kind of make the case for Winnipeg for other purposes as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's one of those things. So, I work for Economic Development in Winnipeg, and I've been doing that for the last 24 years or so. And what's been quite interesting is that you start to really understand who you are as a community, what makes your community unique and special, from a location perspective, for new investment, for expanded investment for companies that are presently there. And so in this particular instance, you know, we wanted to talk about the fact that we have good quality of life, which is really important in terms of what Amazon is looking for its employees, mm-hmm. and it was mm-hmm. critical. We want to talk about the skilled workforce that we have. We want to talk about our geographic location being in the center of North America. So we have all these different
shipping, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So when you talk about things like, you know, how did we want to present ourselves in terms of the criteria that was set for the RFP, but also those value propositions, we're a transportation distribution hub. And subsequently, Amazon has a lot of operating units that require those particular needs. So subsequently, we made sure that in the proposal, we were building in those component parts so that we wanted to raise that level of awareness within Amazon, not just with respect to the headquarters, but the other things that we think would be suitable for other types of activities that fit under the corporation of Amazon.
So I'm curious, how do you go about putting together something like this? Do you go to other companies that are already there and say, like, what do you guys like about being here? Or do you go to community leaders and say, make a list of everything good about Winnipeg? Like, how do you do it?
Well, it's all the above. I mean, what you do is you start off with market intel, because everything has to be evidence-based when you're presenting information. But at the same time, it's this balance between taking quantitative information and qualitative. So the quantitative is your statistical information in terms of who you are as a jurisdiction. Your qualitative is exactly what you said. You speak to companies, you speak to leaders, both political, community leaders, and you get the input from them. And you combine those two together, that basically starts to tell a story. Because it's a story about your community. And the way you do that is that balance between your qualitative and your quantitative. And when you mesh it together, basically what you're able to do is to be able to sell your community based on what those value propositions are. So it included a lot of internal staff. We have a very, very talented staff at Economic Development Winnipeg. We also tap into our very broad network that exists within the city, both, once again, from the post-secondary institutions, research facilities, the private sector and government. And you mesh that all together to be able to put your best story forward. And that's effectively what we did. 6 weeks is a very, very compressed time frame in terms of putting this together, as you can imagine. And I think that we did a very good job in representing our community.
I'm talking to Greg Dandewich, who works for Economic Development in Winnipeg. So what are you might have hit them already, but I just want to back up the major categories that you look to sort of sell yourself in. So you said, one, you're a transportation shipping center. So that obviously is crucial for a company like Amazon. You got a workforce, right?
Correct.
What else? Quality of life?
You talk about quality of life. You talk about connectivity in terms of being able to get in and out of the community. You talk about your skilled workforce. You talk about the institutions that you have. You're talking about 50,000 people that they're going to require over a 10 to 15 year period as you grow the headquarters. What are your post-secondary institutions known for? What are the number of graduates that are consistent with the type of job skills that the companies are looking for? So you start to position and really dissect your community about, well, what do you really have and how do you put forward those valuable assets so that when you're submitting something, in this instance, to Amazon, you're unearthing all the things that they're not aware of. And what we found out is that there's a lot of things that we learned about our community as well as you start to dig deep into really trying to understand who you are as a jurisdiction.
That's part of why it's worth it to go through
Absolutely.
This.
I mean, it was well worth it, once again, simply because of the fact that when a corporation does something like this, you basically make sure that you provide something because they're requesting it. So you learn a lot about yourself in this exercise, and it also allows you to kind of gain a greater understanding in terms of how do we move forward on the next opportunity that is presented to our jurisdiction, something that fits more within the construct of our value proposition. And so that's the way we actually approached this. It was an all hands on deck type of exercise. And it was one of the best exercises that I've gone through in my career thus far.
As we're standing here conducting this interview in North Dakota, I have to ask you, did you bring up the weather at all?
you know what? I would say this. You cannot change where we are geographically. I describe our weather as we would describe, as you would describe the weather in Fargo, North Dakota. It's exotic. And so that's the way we present ourselves. Yeah,
exotic. Okay. Now, you know, one of the things I was curious about, because, of course, we've heard, as I said, the two closest places that were really making a serious bid, Winnipeg and the Twin Cities. And so we heard some about the Twin Cities and Minnesota and them making their bid. But I heard an analyst say that he thought actually Toronto was going to be the winner. And one of the things he talked about, he said there's some positives to being just being in Canada.
Right.
Did you look at that?
Yeah, absolutely. So
what
you,
are those?
Well, when you start to take, when you present something on an international basis, what you do is you talk about who you are as a nation and some of those unique characteristics. And then, of course, you distill it down to your own jurisdiction around some of those unique qualities that you have. So from a Canadian perspective, one of the lowest corporate tax rates in the world that we have. We have a universal healthcare system.
And when so the company doesn't have to pay for health insurance.
That's correct. So when you start to break down those numbers, they're very, very impactful, particularly when you're talking about a $5 billion investment with 50,000 employees coming in. So, you know, Canada...
And that brings in immigration, was one of the other...
Absolutely.
Canada has a different attitude toward immigration.
Absolutely. And that's just, you know, has been the way we have grown our nation. You know, we're a small nation of 37 million people. We're only going to grow by having, you know, really meaningful and acceptable immigration policies, which have started at the national level and, of course, have been embraced at the local level, both provincial and at the city level. So those are some unique qualities that I think distinguish ourselves from the United States or Mexico in this particular instance. And so what you do is you have to talk about who you are as a nation, and then you once again have to take that down and wrap it into the qualities that you have with your specific jurisdiction, in this instance, Winnipeg and Manitoba.
You know, let me ask you something at the risk of opening up the floodgates, since you work in economic development. But, you know, I don't watch this kind of news from Winnipeg. What is the line of economic development in Winnipeg? Has it been growing, staying the same? What's been going on?
Yeah, I mean, the economy has been growing quite nicely. It's really built around a very diverse economy. And so when you take a look at what acts as our underpinning, there's a lot of the traditional industries, which is agribusiness. So the Center of Agriculture is located in Winnipeg. Transportation logistics, simply because of the fact that you have to move these bulk agricultural commodities. We have two of the top five trucking companies in the country that's located in the headquarters of Winnipeg. Life sciences with the Canadian Science Center for Human and Animal Health, which is our virology lab, or our level four, which would be equivalent to what you'd have in Atlanta. Financial services is a very important driver for our economy. Aerospace, third largest in Canada, largest in Western Canada. So you've got this diverse pool of sectors that have struck a good balance in terms of growth. But if one of those sectors start to turn down because of global conditions, you have about eight or nine others that actually bolster the economy moving forward. So we've seen excellent population growth, once again, to your point, based on immigrants that are coming in, skilled immigrants coming into the marketplace. And our GDP has been tracking at around 2.5%. So I think we're in a good position, and we have been over the last decade or so. And, you know, in terms of the role of an economic development professional and our organization, we continue to raise the level of awareness of who we are. We talk about those value propositions based on evidence-based information we have, develop strong networks. It's about economic gardening, and that means supporting what you have in your market and leveraging those ecosystems in terms of attracting new investment into the market.
Well, thank you, Greg Dandowich, for talking to us about this. Greg's on the works for economic development in Winnipeg. He's also on the Prairie Public Board. And, you know, who knows, Greg, maybe next time I go to a festival in Winnipeg, the Amazon drones will be delivering the snacks.
Yeah, wouldn't that be fantastic? Great. It's my pleasure, Bill. Thanks.
Prairie Public's Bill Thomas. Coming up on Main Street, a look at the Lawrence Welk Homestead.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. The Ludwig and Christina Welk Homestead, built in 1893, is an historic farmhouse in Strasburg, North Dakota. It is, of course, also known as the birthplace of Lawrence Welk. This Friday, the Prairie Pulse television show will feature the homestead. And in the following excerpt, we'll hear from Merle Poverud, director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota, and NDSU history professor Tom Ezern.
One and two and...
Welk Place is a unique but a very common farmstead, as I've seen it in my lifetime. We drive down 83 and then there's a turnoff and it's a gravel road. You drive down the gravel and then you have to take this pathway up to the farm. It's nestled in this little island right on Baumgartner Lake. First thing you see is the barn because it's red and it's the biggest building there.
Well, well, well. What a beautiful audience we have this evening.
The Welk Barn is pretty much a typical prairie barn. It's not the Cadillac of barns. It's not a bad barn. It's kind of a typical barn.
Friends, I think you'll enjoy this week's Lawrence Welk Show featuring some of the wonderful songs from the Broadway musicals.
It's not a real big building, but functional. It has a hay loft where you'd put some hay, and in the wintertime you'd have to feed the cattle, so that was a good place to have it, and good place for the cats to have their kittens up there and things like that.
The Welk Homestead, and then our activity in restoring the Welk Barn, is important for several reasons. You know, we don't have any state historic site in this state that deals with homesteading and pioneer farming. What a statement in North Dakota, you know. Well, we need that. We have no state historic site that treats specifically the ethnocultural history of the Germans from Russia, our state's largest cultural group. Well, we need that. We don't have any state historic site in that whole south central North Dakota area, for that matter. And we need that as kind of a linchpin in the historic landscape of German-Russian country there.
Folks, here's a short preview of our show this week. A salute to our senior citizens.
Most of the buildings are in very good shape. There will be some work done on the barn. There's a story to be told there, and I'd hate to lose that structure. So that is probably our biggest challenge. But we want to, you know, put it together so people can actually go in and see things.
Fundamentally, the barn looked pretty good, but it had become unsafe. When we started going in to do the repair work on it, we found that there were some joists that weren't tied to the studs, and I began to get a little nervous at that point. So we took particular care as we were disassembling the loft decking, for instance. Only do a little bit at a time and put it back, you know. Let's keep this thing holding together while we're working on it. It's not unsafe anymore.
At the State Historical Society, we have a unique responsibility, and that's historic preservation. And we take that seriously. I mean, we preserve artifacts and items and pictures and people that people have owned. But preservation of buildings and structures, which are important to understanding North Dakota, is one thing that we really focus on. And the Welk Homestead provides us with an opportunity to do that.
Good night, sleep tight, and pleasant dreams to you. Here's a wish.
Merle Poverud with the State Historical Society and NDSU Professor Tom Ezern. You can watch the Prairie Pulse television show this Friday evening at 7:30 Central. And this week's show will also feature Letitia Hellerud, author of Being at Home in the World. Hellerud is a native of Burundi, and she spent years as a refugee before finding a home in North Dakota. Next on Main Street, Dakota Datebook.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 8th. Today, we bring you a story of a man who made life in winter a whole lot easier. Andrew Freeman was born in 1909 and grew up in Upham, North Dakota. In 1932, he graduated from the University of North Dakota with a degree in electrical engineering, and he went on to become widely known as the visionary who managed the Minn Kota Power Cooperative for 40 years. As a kid, Freeman was interested in how people started their cars in cold weather, including the town mailman. Freeman reported that the mailman drained the oil out every night and kept it warm in the house and put it back in the car in the morning. Other folks would shovel hot coals from their furnace and put them under the car to heat the engine. Another trick was to use tea kettles to pour hot water over the intake manifold. "We had a Model A Ford," said Freeman. "When we wanted to start it, we'd go out and fire up a stove in the garage." It was around 1940 that Freeman decided to find a better way. He found some copper tubing in a pile of rubble and put it together with a heating element from an old iron. In a 1979 interview, Freeman said, "I tried it out on the car one morning when it was 29 below. I made a number of trips to check it. At a 7:45, I stepped on the starter, and it started right out." When word got out about his invention, friends and neighbors started asking for one. And it was on this date in 1949 that Andy received a patent on the Freeman Electric Internal Combustion Engine Head Bolt Heater. It went into production in East Grand Forks, and 4 years later, the factory was turning out about 240,000 units for distribution in 28 states. Today, thanks to electronic ignitions and fuel injection, plugging in the car on cold nights is less common. But for many years, Andrew Freeman's invention was a much-welcomed necessity. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with author Leticia Mizero Hellerud about her new book, Being at Home in the World. She emigrated to the U.S. from Burundi some years ago. And we'll take a look at the family homestead of Lawrence Welk. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
Chrissy Houlihan was ready to watch Hillary Clinton be elected president.
We sat down with balloons at the ready and champagne, and the night, as we know, kind of went sideways, at least for me.
And her disappointment has led to a new direction. Now she is running for a seat in Congress. I'm David Green. A year after the election, we ask, what's next for Democrats? That's on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, Ashley Thornburg visits with comedian Cheech Marin, who's speaking at UND about his collection of Chicano art. Chef Tim Rosendahl will be here to talk about putting some American buffalo on your plate, and we'll share our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.